during the break. A couple of people told me responses to the instruction I gave about perceiving the brightness of mind. Now, don't worry if your mind isn't at all bright tonight. It's okay. Sometimes it gets shrouded and dull, and you know, we get shrouded and duller. It's okay. But something about our brightness is more closer, I could say, to what we are. And I told them that when I practiced in another tradition, in the Chan tradition, which is like an arm of Zen, it's from Chinese Zen, there were no meditation instructions apart from the teacher would sit at the front and say, 30 minutes, make your mind bright. Right? Right. The instructions that we have in our tradition, which are beautiful and detailed and precise and go further and further, are in the service of really of one thing only. Not to become excellent. Well, yes, there is a certain excellence, but not to become an excellent person later on when you've mastered it. But to see, we see clearly into all these phenomena in order actually to leave it alone, in order to take our hands off it, in order to see that the things that arise internally and externally, what arises internally, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, sensations, all of that, none of those things arising internally or externally can be the home that we seek for. They cannot be the thing that gives us that final moment where we go, ah, oh, where we cease in our pulling and pushing, our going towards something and running away. So all those meditation instructions to look into experience are to leave it alone, because we don't. We don't leave it alone. We get busy with it and we suffer. So make your mind bright. And mind isn't just the head center in the Buddhist tradition. It includes the head center. And some of you will know this can be bright, right? You're all probably bright enough, folks. Yeah. It's the head center. It's the heart center. It's what is known as the citta. The citta is the whole sensitive, intelligent, resonant, palpating, gets translated as heart mind. Right? It includes the intellect, but it's not at all limited by that. That's just a small part of it, we could say. And I put it to you that you know this experience of citta when we say I'm feeling in a bad mood, right? Citta, we don't necessarily know it, but the heart mind is a little contracted, tight, hardened, or like concrete. Anyone ever felt their heart or mind just hard? Sometimes the heart mind can be spacious, radiant, light, luminous, empty, kind. But to know it and to know what runs through it, all the programs that run through our heart mind, programs of thinking we have to be somewhere else doing something else. Do any of you ever have that program? One of my students, I think it was yesterday or the day before, she said, my mind always has the program that whatever I'm doing right now, I should be doing something else. Right? Never quite this, never quite devoting herself or herself in that moment, in that case, to this moment. So making the mind bright, we can't force it to be bright, can we? We can't make it bright, but we can do our practice, which is a little bit like taking off the shrouds. Do you have the same word in Swedish? Shroud. Shroud's what you wrap a dead person up in traditionally. What do you call that? Okay. Yeah, it's like the shrouds can relax and come off a little bit. And the reflection in the tradition given, invited we are to reflect upon death. Because I'm just attracted to the sound again. It's our it's great, isn't it? It's our 4 times an hour mindfulness moment. It's great. It's like, really? Why? That's what the practice is. We use what arises, right? All of it. Nothing is in the way. We use what arises to see if the mind is leaning in. I think mine leaned in a little bit then, right? If our mind is leaning in or our mind is pulling away, we just get to see that, right? And we train it to come back, take our hands off phenomena, and they unfold by themselves. So the reflection on death, because at that point, if not before, our shrouds are taken off for us. The masks, the personality shell, the things that we've leaned on for our support or security, that will be parted from that. And the invitation in the practice is to take off those shrouds now. Take off those shrouds now. And in doing so, see what you discover, see what you find out. I found out recently that in the British Museum, probably very unproudly, probably another one of these stolen artifacts from other countries, I'm sorry to say, but there's an artifact of an early representation of the Buddha. And for those of you that know, these kinds of images came, I think, 500 or 600 years after the time of the Buddha, at least, I think, and have the mixture of the Greek influence with the images of Apollo, right? You can see the relationship. That in those first many years, images weren't made in the human form of the Buddha, and there were various representations. One, I understand, is the footprints, right? That you'll know the being, the Buddha, the awakening, by the impression that she or he leaves on the earth, that he left his footprint, his Dharma footprint. And actually that's still having an effect today, right? Such was the compassion and the intelligence in that teaching. But at the British Museum there's an image, apparently, that's bas-relief of the tree, the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment, the tree the Buddha sat under when he made his determination to wake up. And there's a tree, and underneath it is a sunshine, right, under the tree. There's not a human image or the footsteps. It's a sunshine underneath the tree. And the research shows, apparently, that in the time of the Buddha, that the sun was worshipped. It was an agrarian society that clearly had a strong relationship with the sun. And part of his teaching was to make that universal, that it wasn't just this outside sunshine. It was something about the waking up that was radiant, that shone light, that was warm and melted through those shrouds of the personality, such that what was left sitting under the Bodhi tree was a sunshine. Right? There's a human body there, I assume, right? But that what has got clarified was all the ideas and images of who he thought he was. And that he was known, apparently, as the solar friend. And he came from the solar lineage. So there's something of this theme of light and sunshine that I'm offering tonight, that fits with our practice of waking up as that natural radiance of what we are, as we trust it a little bit more, as we practice it with it a little bit more, we can let go some of the obscurations, the shrouds, the clothes, literally like let the clothes come off. Yeah, so the Buddha known as from the solar lineage, and he was called the solar friend, the one who casts light upon the path. Right? Who sheds light, illuminates the path for those wanting to wake up. And I like to bring this image of the solar, the sun here, because for those of you who've been around this tradition many years, and I know some of you have, and I don't know all of you, so I don't know exactly what you know and where you've been, but the cooling aspect of Dharma is a beautiful aspect. The cooling, almost like the, more like the night sky, the cooling, the vast, cool, empty quality of Dharma is very well articulated and discussed in the tradition, and we practice with that. But for our path to be complete, we need to consider that from that, this is like poetic metaphor tonight, but from that dark night's sun, that dark night's potentiality, right? That potent, empty, dark, that the sun dawns from that and casts light into the world. So I'm guessing that the Buddha didn't think, oh great, I'm a sunshine now. You know, that's very cool. I think the work of the radiance, and it is not like you're going to get there, you all have your degree of that light, right? We just get confused with it. Light is something very, you know more about light in this country, light and dark. We have a really strong relationship with light and dark here that I see when I come in May and the lights come back usually. And it's very touching actually, because we often come in May. It wasn't like that tonight, but one of the first things I notice is the way you all who've grown up here sort of just turn. It's very noticeable. There's something about the light that we're attracted to, right? But there's something about the light that can be dazzling, confusing, mesmerizing. You know, some people are feel very radiant and light, but it's sort of, you know, it's not clear or not wise or not clarified, and we get drawn in and it's confusing. But the clarified light, where we've done our work or we do our work, the personality can relax and the light can shine forth for the benefit of beings. So today I was practicing with this. I was in Stockholm Central. We arrived this afternoon, actually, to Stockholm Central, and Christina was coming to pick us up, and it's big in Stockholm Central. We didn't find each other, and we had to check, so we waited a little while at the bottom of platform 10, those staircase that goes up to the Vasagarten exit down at the bottom, and I was there on my own with the two suitcases while my husband looked for Christina. And I don't live in a city. I grew up in London, but I don't live in a city anymore. So I was struck by the sheer volume of human beings, especially at 4:45 or 4:50. You know, the sheer just volume, right? And I noticed that on my mind, of course, was looking for Christina. So that would, but Yanai was taking care of that. So I could just practice. I could just feel my feet on the ground, be in under whatever, wherever I was, Stockholm Central, and witness this sea of humanity. And first, what I notice first, of course, is the, you know, this one's like that, and that one's like that, and there's two of those, and there's three of those, and I wonder. You know, we get caught, this is the ordinary mind, naturally enough, on the, what the Buddha would call, the signs and particulars, right? The detail, the bits that, oh, I'm interested in that and I'm not interested in that. That's where we get caught. That's where we get snagged or dragged. We forget something fundamental that is prior to all of that incredible diversity, but something that is even more fundamental than that. Not negating the diversity lets us actually perceive it more in its glory, but something more fundamental we overlook. I recently heard that a child learned this in a geography lesson at school, that she came home to a friend of mine who's her aunt and said, I have seen more people today, meaning at school, I think, than most humans in the entire evolution of human history ever saw in their whole lifetime. Did I say that right? So I saw more people today, maybe 1,000, 1,500 children at school, than most people will have ever seen in their lifetime if you take the whole of the human story into account. You know, because we were less for a start, but we were in small villages and whatever, or before that, we were moving around, right? I don't know if it's true. But you can see something about it, and the argument was posited that evolutionarily we haven't caught up with dealing with that many strangers yet. So I'm getting to the point. The point is the teaching about kindness, actually, and about where our heart mind opens and where it closes. That we haven't caught up with dealing with that many folks that we don't know if they're friend, foe, mate, food, whatever, you know, they're that sort of primary wiring for that. So how do we work? How do we work when this sea of beings, humans and other beings, is our environment? Is our environment. And in fact, you know, with the environmental crisis, one of the ways that some people's mind goes is around, you know, too many humans, etc., etc. But actually, maybe from the practice perspective, we're missing something. That's possible for us. Two things I want to share. I heard quite recently, actually, about a really interesting man called John Francis in the United States, who in the early 70s witnessed an oil spill off of California. And he made, in the 71, a big devastating oil spill, and he made a vow in that moment not to travel in motorized transport, right? He saw that there was a correlation between the oil industry and these animals struggling. It turned out that this continued for 17 years. He walked all the way across North America many, many times. He did it in silence. He also decided that he was somebody who talked too much and that mostly wound people up. So he decided to take a vow of silence week by week, and it just lasted for 17 years. And he's known as Planet Walker. It's not quite the whole planet, but anyway, it's right. He's known as Planet Walker, and he got 3 environmental degrees and a master's during that time. And eventually his path changed, and that was no longer true for him, so those vows ended and something else is happening. But his very interesting reflection after all of that, when he teaches about the environment, which he knows a lot about, he says, we are the environment. And his whole focus now is on the way the human, at this point, the human realm meets each other. That the relational field of the human realm, this is the environment, it's what happened between us. It's our confusion about self and other, right, that leads us to take more and push away. So right back to our practice, our confusion about who and what we are, who and what the world is, what we do with this life while it's here, clarifying that confusion is the work of our Dharma practice, is the work of our meditative arts. Our work, we could say, the awakening that is possible is the awakening of this heart-mind just getting a little bit more clear, just a couple more shrouds, I dare to see. A little bit more light is shed on the ways I pull back in Stockholm Central or the ways I think I have to fix everybody. I come back to this middle seat. Breathe out. See the ways I want to move away from the world. See the ways I want to try and control the world. They're the two extremes, we could say. And I don't mean the world, the whole world. I mean the way I try and control my poor husband, right? Right? Or the way I want to pull back when my neighbor opens her door and I can't really be bothered to be human that day. But that is not divorced from the totality which we share together. Taking care of my confusion about self and other. So practicing in Stockholm Central, there's all the detail, fast, many. Mind can say too many. It's just a thought. What does that mean? In that moment, breathing, sensing, feeling maybe the flicker of the light, where the light flickers and is not steady. And it's like, oh, the world. You know, any of you ever feel a bit flickery about the world? Like, oh, right, that the light sometimes flickers and we can breathe out and steady it. Ah, yeah, this. There's lots of stories tonight, it seems, but one cartoon I like very much. Calvin and Hobbes, I think it's American. He's a little six-year-old guy. His fantasy world gets played out in the cartoon captions. And he's watching telly, first picture. Watching telly and his mum shouts, "Go out and play!" And he shouts, "No!" And again, "Go out and play! No!" And eventually she pulls him out off the seat in front of the telly, sticks him outside the back door, and she says, "Go outside and play," and he's still resisting. And she says, "Why not?" And he looks up, the last picture, he's looking up, and he says, "It's too real." It's too real. So our spiritual practice is not to find, and actually not to find an other reality, but to wake up in this one. In fact, what was remarkable about the Buddha is he shifted the focus in the spiritual orientation away from the super cosmic being that we might abstract and want to move towards, which has its place. He moved that to a concern for the finite, the fragile, and the mortal. That was the shift. Concern for that which is fragile, finite, and mortal. Waking up through this, in and through this apparatus. And that's where the kindness makes sense. The kindness seems it's a Scandinavian word, kindred. Is that one of yours? Kind, or is that, did we get that from someone else? Vänlig. What is it?
Vänlig.
Vänlig, kindred, is that kindred? So kind, in English, the word kind has the same root as kindred, and kindred is like old English for your tribe. They're my kin. These are my kin, right? Yeah. And that our kindness, our wish to care for the fragile, the finite, and the mortal would be extended probably to our kin, hopefully. Right? Those we see as the same as me, those we see as mine. Kindness in the teaching points us to any limitation on that radiant heart that is considered actually boundless, without end, immeasurable. This radiant kindness can be without end. Where are the ways we put that limitation on it? As we practice, we see that more and more beings get included in my kin, my kind. We're the kind that are sensitive. We're the kind that want to be loved, that want safety and protection, that want to be cared for, that want to express our love, that want to be free, that want... What kind are we? Right. The kind that thinks, the kind that feels. As we go wider, that kindred can include more and more and more beings. And nothing is left out. Everything. We are the kind that comes. We could say, in this metaphor, we are the kind that somehow just gets born and emerges from that great potent void, we could say, and suddenly we're here. We're that kind, along with quite a few other humans and many, many animals, plus everything else. Right, all these sentient kind that suddenly find themselves here together on this planet at this time. When our mind picks that, or when my mind picks that up, sometimes it can say, too many, too much, can't go there, I'm not there, I'm just struggling getting up in the morning. Right? Can we understand and have, well, I offer you the relationship between that very same work of taking care of what arises here and the way that is part of our world work as we clarify our own pains, as we learn to, as we steady the mind, as we stabilize a little bit more, we take our seat. Yes, we're with mindfulness of body breathing, and then what arises into that space? Well, sometimes what arises is our love and our radiance and our beautiful qualities. Sometimes it's our stuff, right? Very often it's our stuff. Our... what do you have? The stuff that doesn't appear to be so radiant, right? The stuff that appears to limit our immeasurable heart. The stuff that appears more petty, mean. Anyone have the odd mean thought? Mean, unkind, jealous, rageful, impatient, pushy, demanding, collapsed. What else? What have I missed out? There's many, aren't there? Many, many, many things that can snag our mind and we think, oops, I shouldn't have that, I should... No, that too, seen by the bright heart, can become transparent to the brightness, can in a way burn up in the brightness, not because we reject it, but because we love it. That too is born out of the great mystery. The Dalai Lama, who's... somebody told us in the break that her granddaughter came in and saw a picture of the Dalai Lama on her fridge, I think, and said, who's that uncle? Right? Who's that uncle? Best kind of uncle. Oh, and as many of you know, he's famous for saying, my religion is kindness. Full stop. the Buddha in Vipassana, actually, so coming from the Satipatthana of the Buddha, the brilliant discourses of describing the practice of looking into experience to see where we cling and releasing the clinging. Satipatthana is the piece that mostly in our insight tradition in the West has gotten brought forth, the retreats in silence. This is what we mostly teach. The Buddha taught two ways to excellence. Sometimes it's translated as Satipatthana and Metta Bhavana. Metta as kindness and Bhavana as cultivation, like gardening. Metta Bhavana. And I have it on good authority from some great scholars of Pali, which is the language of the tradition, and great teachers, that if you look really deeply into the way this is taught, that they result in the same thing. That the insight, when we see more and more clearly into the nature of things, we release the grip, softens and widens, what do we find? We find the confusion of self and other goes away. That only leaves the kind heart, which is natural, which is our nature. That mindfulness and heartfulness aren't two different things, actually. That we literally can know, that Vipassana really helps us have this aspect of knowing and seeing clearly. This seeing clearly isn't just the bright, cool head. It's the bright, cool head with the bright, warm heart that comes into the world with the eye of kindness. It's a knowing, it's like a knowing phenomena, for knowing experience as of the same kind. So what does this mean when we're sitting on the cushion? It means, how would it be as you cast your eyes toward experience of breath, of body, sensation, feeling, that you meeting them like you meet another being in Stockholm Central? And that's what we're probably doing. We are, actually. If we're there with our head down in Stockholm, I've done this, I used to live in London, you know, just getting through the underground on the way to work with that kind of, maybe you don't do that here, it's, London is known for it, people are kind of buckled down in the tube because there's so many, and that's what people say, there's so many people, right? If we're doing that on the tube, we're lightly doing that in our meditation. Check it out. Have a look. We're lightly coming to meditation, right? How can I not be too impacted here? Right? How can I not have too many beings show up all at once? Or if we're in the other extreme that we have to, in order to be someone who we think we should be, I go out and say hi to everyone in Stockholm Station. Now, if that's true for me, very good. But it's not lightly true, really true for everyone. Then I might get lost in the sea of things. I might get lost in my inner experience. A breath arises and I'm totally into it. A thought arises, I'm lost, I'm gone. A feeling arises and I'm lost in it. The middle way, with the eye of kindness, breath arises, body arises, sensations arise, thoughts, feelings, images, perceptions. The heart is bright, awake, and kindly knows experience. In this way, it can arise in order to be liberated, in order to move on. This is our possibility. This is possible for us. This is possible. Please, okay. Okay. So I read this. I'll just do a little bit more and then before I stop. There's this nice book that's just come out in... I don't know if books come out in one place anymore. Anyway, it's a book that's come out by a British philosopher called Alain de Botton. He's called, and he's got a book called Religion for Atheists. And he has a lovely analysis of saying us atheists have literally thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Do you have that idiom? Yeah. And he's saying, let's look at all the good things that spiritual traditions have brought us and see what we can learn. And see if you can spot the piece that he's pointing to of what comes from the spiritual tradition. He's talking about judgment, critical judgment, one of the things that shuts down the kindness, judgment of ourselves or others. A harsh judgment. He says this. I'm supplied with tools. Yeah. The unsympathetic assessment we make of others... Have you ever done that? The unsympathetic assessment we make of others are usually the result of nothing more sinister than our habit of looking at them the wrong way. Right? Through lenses clouded by distraction, exhaustion, and fear, which blind us to the fact that they are really, despite a thousand differences, just altered versions of ourselves, fellow, fragile, uncertain, flawed beings, likewise craving love and in urgent need of forgiveness. Did you spot the Dharma part in there? The training in attention, he said, because we're looking at them the wrong way. Our attention isn't trained. Dharma teachings train our attention to look in ways that lead to more freedom and happiness, actually. The untrained attention, the untrained mind, I don't mean intellectual mind, but the attention, where we place our attention. Untrained, don't know about you, but where I see my mind goes or picks up or spins or starts to believe as reality, you know, at best, it's okay. At worst, it can be really, really not helpful. Spiritual practice, we train our attention. It's not just a reconditioning. It's not like putting a plaster over something that's difficult. It's a training of attention that cuts through the surface static that we get caught in. Oh, you're like that and they're like that and it feels like this. And cutting through the static to something that is more real, actually. More wholesome, that leads onward and where we can respond with intelligence. So I think I'm going to finish in a minute that I read you this poem called Kindness. This is from Naomi Shihab Nye, and she's a Palestinian American, I believe. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted carefully, all this must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out of the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead at the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow, you must speak to it, till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then, it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail your letters and purchase your bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. May all beings be safe and protected from danger. May all beings rest deeply on the earth. May all beings receive what they need. May all beings know joy. And may all beings be released from suffering and the causes of suffering.